want to welcome everyone here this morning to the first stage of the DC tour of Jim Traub's book, The Freedom Agenda. My name is Alex Lennon. I'm the editor of CSIS's journal, The Washington Quarterly, and I also direct a project called Democracy and Future U.S. Security Strategy. And I'd like to welcome you all this morning. Jim Traub, as you know, rather than go through the bio, is a contributing editor for New York Times Magazine, and is half-time director of the policy for the Global Center for Responsibility to Protect, which gives him an interesting perspective on this issue, and one that I think will explore some of his original reasons for writing the book in the discussion. What we'd like to do is have him talk for about 15 to 20 minutes or so, just to sort of introduce the book, which is available in the back for those of you, as you may know. And then I'll talk for about 10 to 15 minutes with you for a conversation, and then we'll open it up for about the last 25 or 30 or so for questions from the audience. With that, let me turn it over to you, Jim.
Well, thanks so much. I'm so delighted to be here on the first stage of my assault of Washington. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to see the movie W yet. It features a profoundly delusional president who somehow thinks that he can democratize the Middle East. And the thing I felt watching it was not so much, oh my God, I hope nobody sees this movie because they'll think that these stuff I've written about in my book is ludicrous. It's rather that I think this in fact reflects the public mood. I think there is a deep sense right now of skepticism, cynicism, disgust about the whole idea that America can actively do good in the world, that we can have an idealistic foreign policy, a value-driven foreign policy. And I think this is a kind of exhaustion, both with the grandiose and sweeping rhetoric that President Bush used to describe the democracy agenda, and of course the actions themselves, and above all, anything that has to do with Iraq. So first, I think that there is a kind of mood of retrenchment in the world, or at home. And obviously the economic crisis adds to this enormously, because we would have assumed until relatively recently that the election was a kind of referendum on the war on terror. And clearly that's not so anymore. So the whole question of foreign affairs has also retreated a little bit to the background. And then finally, there's just the question of money. I'm sure some of you noticed that when Joe Biden was asked during the vice presidential debate, is there one program you can name that you would cut, that you will cut because of the bailout? What did he choose? He chose foreign aid. Not hard to understand why. Foreign aid is the only money we spend on non-voters. So always politically an easy call. But discouraging, given that increased donor assistance actually is quite central to Obama's view of how we need to change the world. And that's just describing, obviously, how people feel at home, how people feel who are, in effect, on the receiving end of this democracy promotion thing. You know, that we know all too well, the anger at the United States, the sense that it's all about regime change and so on. And especially in the Middle East, where you find overwhelming fractions of the public think that democracy promotion has been a terrible and harmful idea. And even I culled this recently, a recent poll, the question was, U.S. involvement in the region justifies armed operations against the U.S. everywhere, agree or disagree, and majorities in Jordan, Palestine, Algeria, and Kuwait agreed. Lebanon, thank God, was a little below 40%. So that's where things stand now. If we ask, how did we get here? How did this thing go so profoundly awry? There are some reasons that I think we all know. I don't really know quite how to rank them. Clearly, a big part of it was a complete failure on the part of the Bush administration to grapple with the inherent difficulty of this colossally difficult venture. There was a kind, and here I think the movie is all too correct, there was a magical sensibility, which I think emanated from Bush himself, which somehow imagined that American power and American benevolence can transform what otherwise had been a status quo of generations or of centuries. And this predates Iraq. I mean, from the first time Bush talks about the idea of bringing democracy to the Middle East, actually it was in 2002 when he challenged the Palestinians And just to remind you of that kind of language, he said, if liberty can blossom in the rocky soil of the West Bank and Gaza, it will inspire millions of men and women around the globe who are equally weary of poverty and oppression and equally entitled to the benefits of democratic government. Now, having made that extraordinary statement, what did we do exactly to help liberty blossom in the rocky soil of the West Bank and Gaza? And the answer was nothing. It was a kind of rhetorical challenge, which we somehow imagined that people would rise to. And so there was a profound sense of blitheness. And I think I'm hardly the first person to say that the Bush administration and Bush himself suffered from this magical sensibility, which disconnected means and ends. So that one spoke of magnificent ends and applied to them only the most modest means. And I think this probably especially applies to the Middle East, obviously the most intransigent area to seek to change political culture and to produce democratic reform. Had it been elsewhere in the world, it might not have seemed such an utter failure, but of course it would not have gone to the Bush administration's vision of, in effect, curing terrorism through democracy promotion. So that's one. And two, of course, is Iraq. I mean, Iraq has, in effect, turned all messages into Iraq. No matter what you say, the answer is Iraq. So in terms of these responsibility to protect issues, you know, you talk about humanitarian intervention. The answer is, oh, you mean like Iraq? And of course, the same is true with democracy promotion. And so even though the administration could say, we didn't go into Iraq for that, of course, the intervention was accompanied by all that language. There was that expectation. We'd heard the language before about the Palestinian territories. We heard it later about Egypt. So Iraq, in fact, quite rightly created this link in the public mind between democracy promotion and regime change, that you can bring democracy through a Bradley fighting vehicle. And clearly more broadly than that, the sense that America was an utterly unfit carrier of this idea because of Guantanamo, because of rendition, because of torture. So here was a country that was seeking to make itself the incarnation and preacher of a set of this deep set of values of democracy, which it was dishonoring at the same time. So a weird lack of sense that one's acts are transparent in the world, and that if people hear us having an active debate about how much we can torture people and who can torture people and under what circumstances we can torture people, that somehow won't have any effect on their view of our ability to do this kind of preaching. And we do live in a transparent world now. And you often thought that the Bush administration just didn't know that. And it seems to me this is a profound change in the world which our next administration is going to have to take into account. Finally, I think, there was a lack of persistence. Look at a situation like Egypt, where we actually quite boldly, Secretary Rice went to Cairo in June of 2005 and said, for 60 years we've sacrificed democracy in the name of stability. And we've gotten neither, and now we won't do that anymore. And for all that I've just said about how America is disliked around the world and the language, nevertheless, it was a very exciting moment in Egypt. People were very skeptical and very worried, but they believed it. And we did, in fact, manage to force a real opening. There were elections that were more open than they would have been otherwise. Mubarak realized he was losing, and he sent his goons out into the street and crushed the opposition and killed 18, 19, 20 people, mostly members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And our response was nothing. Because at some level, one end of the Bush doctrine, the war on terror end, contradicted the other end of the Bush doctrine, the democracy promotion one, and in the end we came down on the side of the war on terror end. So that's where we find ourselves. And I don't think it's too presumptuous to say the question is, can the President Obama that is to be cure this? Does he want to cure this? I think the answer to the second question is yes. He approaches this in a very specific way that has to do, I think, with his own experience. He's acutely aware that what America looks like in the world enormously affects its ability to do something in the world. And I take it that comes from having been brought up looking at America from a distance. And I remember in a speech he gave, more than a year ago, July of 2007, he talked about being a senator and flying over some disaster area in Africa by helicopter, as they always do, looking down some boy on the ground and thinking, what does that boy think when he looks up at the helicopter? And the point of that thought is it matters greatly to America's own ability to act in the world, what people have in their heads about America. So I think he starts with that deep sense, and with the sense of himself as at least potentially a transformational agent in terms of how America acts in the world and how it's understood in the world. So there's the will to do something. And so then that raises the question, well, what can he do? What should he do? And it seems to me the first thing we have to do is we have to talk about ourselves in a different way. That is, the whole self-righteousness of Bush's presentation was not only ugly in itself and deeply arrogant, but also obnoxious to those on the receiving end. There has to be a sense that all democracies are flawed, that all democracies are our experiments, our works in progress. Ours is profoundly flawed, and our reaction to 9/11 strikes me as a proof of those flaws. And I think Obama needs to find a language in which he can speak honestly that way, not shamefully, but candidly. And then, of course, we need to talk about the rest of the world in a very different way. We need to find a more modest and less millennial way of talking about the world. Perhaps we need to talk a little bit less about promotion, about the idea that we can somehow install something in places, more about how we can nurture what is already there, clearly more in terms of working with allies, more in terms of working with the United Nations. I think also one of the great flaws of the Bush administration was to completely disconnect democracy promotion from state building. Because, of course, they didn't believe in state building. They believed in democracy promotion, but not in state building. And the one, of course, is very exciting, dramatic, wonderful, climactic. And the other is slow, tedious, expensive, time-consuming. But we have to recognize that that's the foundation of this thing. And so I think he has to restore this sense that we have this obligation that has to do with state building. We clearly need to find some way of figuring out the relationship between the war on terror and this idea of doing something inside states. In the case of the Bush administration, you could see this contradiction in Egypt. You could see it even much more gravely in Pakistan. I mean, here in Pakistan, we had the answer to President Bush's prayers. Hundreds of thousands of people go out in the street to defend the constitution of Pakistan against a military dictator. And our logic is, well, we need that military dictator. And so we're going to support him. The same logic, obviously, that said we need Pinochet, that said we need Marcos. It's the same Cold War logic, and it's an understandable logic. But if that's our logic, then we can't go talking about democracy promotion if we're going to ignore the most impressive, vivid act of democratic spirit in the Islamic world. So how do we resolve these things? I think it's not effective to talk about democracy promotion as a cure for terrorism. First of all, because it often isn't a cure for terrorism. It's often pointed out that the Philippines is a democracy, which has a big problem of terrorism. China is an authoritarian country, which doesn't have it. I think beyond that, what we're saying to the world is, we want you to change so you don't come kill us. Well, that's also not, strikes me, a very inviting message. So it may be that we need to find a different way of thinking about this whole problem, which perhaps will make more sense if we think about this whole question of fixing failed states. This is something which is very congenial to Obama. Again, in his speeches, he's often said there are 60 weak states in the world. I think failing or failed or fragile, I'm not sure what language he uses. And clearly those are the states from which the kinds of transnational problems that come to haunt us ultimately, whether it's terrorism, narcotics, crime, disease, emanate. And of course, the Army Stabilization Operations Manual just came out, which makes exactly that argument, that this is going to be core to the military doctrine in years to come. That is, the need to stabilize weak states is co-equal with the need to be able to actually wage active hostilities. And so that may be one way of dealing with this democracy problem. Now, it's worth noting that the Stabilization Manual, they had an internal debate, should we use the word democracy or not? And they chose not to do so. I'm not sure why that's the case, but there's this deep sense out there that the word democracy has become an American brand, like McDonald's, you know, a tainted American brand. And I was struck that, for example, in the Princeton Project on National Security, which brought together all the mainstream foreign policy folks, and talks a lot about democracy, but they choose to not use that word. They don't believe in democracy promotion. They say instead we should be seeking a world of liberty under law, and we should support, I can never remember what this stands for, so I had to write it down, PAR, which stands for Popular, Accountable, and Rights Regarding States. Now, those are states I call democracies. Those are democracies. And so I think we cannot and should not try to get around this word. I mean, I think the assumption is that the word democracy is so utterly stigmatized. But is that really so? I mean, in the same poll that showed that Middle Eastern publics think it's okay to attack the United States everywhere because of its behavior, they also asked the following question. Democracy may have its problems, but is better than any other form of government. Agree or disagree? And all of the Middle Eastern publics they asked were somewhere between 90% in agreement with that statement. So I'm very hesitant to say that we should, in fact, do that. And I just want to end by talking a little bit about Pakistan, because here's the place where the fixing failed states or weak states agenda is one and the same as the democracy promotion agenda. Here was a country which had a sympathetic to us military dictator who turned out to be bad for Pakistan and bad for us. Now he's been replaced by a secular, civilian, democratic government who right now may appear to be worse for Pakistan and worse for us. And it really is a kind of direct experiment on this whole question of whether democracy, more democracy, is likely to increase or decrease terrorism. The issue is being played out and will be played out very vividly there. And I suspect that for the next several years, democracy promotion for this next administration is going to be in Pakistan. And so that's really the big question, whether a combination of state building and democracy promotion, in the sense of trying to do whatever we can to prop up democratic, civic, secular institutions in Pakistan, we're going to find out whether or not that works. And I suspect, as I say, that this is going to be the next frontier of this effort. And it will show us that for all the doubts we may have about this word democracy and about this thing called democracy promotion, it is, in fact, indispensable to our own national security. So let me stop there.
Great. Thanks very much. The book itself is really in sort of three parts. There's a good exploration at the beginning about the history of democracy and American security. There's a sense, I think, in some people that don't follow the issue, that the Bush administration sort of started the centrality of democracy promotion, certainly elevated it with the second inaugural address. Let me ask you about the beginning of the book for you. When did you decide to write this book and why?
Well, it's a good question. I decided to write it, a couple years ago, I guess. And I think I decided to write it because I never write about something that I'm totally clear in my own mind about. If it's that straightforward, it always seems to me to be not worth writing about. So here was something I was really torn about, I guess in part because I was reluctant to concede that any doctrine so central to the Bush administration was, at least at the doctrinal level, correct. But I felt that this core 9/11 insight, which is that the inside of states now matter to us in a more urgent way, pardon me, than they did before, that was right. That was right. I mean, the Clinton administration had a similar way of talking about it, but less urgent. They would say that the need to incorporate more and more states into the globalized world, and this is sort of connected to the failed states agenda, is key to our own national security. 9/11 comes along, and something quite new and yet more urgent is added to that pre-existing idea. So I think my wish to try to work this thing out and to see, can you clear the rubble of Bush administration doctrine away from this Bush administration insight in order to see, what's there that works? That seemed like a worthy enterprise to me.
Yeah. The second part of the book, which has in part gotten a lot of the attention, is, of course, the interviews with administration officials.
Yeah.
But you also spend a lot of time interviewing people outside of the U.S. And you chose Egypt and Mali as the two countries to focus on. Why Mali? You talked about Egypt a bit before.
Yeah,
but.
So why Mali? Mali, Egypt doesn't stand for anything in a way. I mean, yes, it's the Middle East, but Egypt is also itself such a big object of this effort. Mali is, you know, an unimportant country in itself, you might say. Mali stands for something. Mali is the world's poorest democracy. Or maybe it's tied with Niger. I think Niger is 173rd out of 177 on the UNDP list, and Mali has now jumped up to 172nd. But it's really a democracy. I mean, classical theory held that there's this evolutionary process. First you build up a set of liberal institutions, you build up a middle class or middle class-like class, which makes a set of political demands, and then ultimately you capitulate to these demands or they get institutionalized. Bingo, you have a democracy. Which clearly, that's not what's happening in the world. We don't live in a world that looks like that. So people are inclined to say, well, it can't be a real democracy if it's that poor. Well, Mali has heads of state who step down when their term ends and are succeeded by somebody else, even though the elections are quite badly rigged. It has a free press, even though it's a relatively meager reach. It has a division of powers. It has all this stuff. But it's unbelievably poor. And so first, analytically, that was interesting. How did it become a democracy? Why do people care about it? What does democracy mean to people? And the answer is it does mean something to people. It means voice. And people actually do care about having a voice. But then, can democracy deliver? How can all these fragile democracies survive if they can't deliver? Now, deliver doesn't only mean prosperity. Deliver also means political goods. Deliver a sense of security. Deliver a sense of dignity. Things that people care about. And also prosperity. And so that's the open question that I try to explore in that chapter. And I am only semi-confident about the democracy prosperity wing. One thing I do highlight there is the workings of the Millennium Challenge account, which has only just begun. It's too early to make a clear judgment, but Mali got $450 million for 3 years, which is a hell of a lot of money in Mali. And it struck me that the plans themselves were very sensible plans. And most importantly, they were Malian plans, which is, here's something I really think needs to be said for the administration, that their anti-paternalistic mentality was actually quite useful in this regard. They said, if we're going to have this new aid program, that it is the beneficiaries who should develop the projects, and it is the beneficiaries who should run the projects with our oversight. So I put some hope by that.
Is the Millennium Challenge account, do you think, one of the diamonds in the rough or part of the rubble that should be preserved by a new administration as a democracy promotion project or part of that?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I talk about Pakistan, it raises the Millennium Challenge account questions. That is, the premise of the Millennium Challenge account is the reason that foreign aid has been wasted is not that foreign aid is inherently useless. It's that until a country is sufficiently non-corrupt, sufficiently focused on helping its own people, sufficiently transparent in its transactions, the money is going to be pissed away. Now, here's Pakistan. Pakistan could never qualify by the standards of the Millennium Challenge account. It's way too corrupt. And there's every reason to fear that the kind of funding that I hope we'll be doing in Pakistan is going to get wasted. It's a real problem. And so I think one thing that the next administration is going to have to do is try to expand on the Millennium Challenge Account idea to incorporate crucial states that, in fact, don't meet the standards of governance and so forth that are required by the MCA.
Mm-hmm. On the U.S. side of the equation, for some of the interviews that you had done, you talked in the discussion at the beginning about how part of the administration, or a great part of the administration's sense of optimism was about the power of the United States, that it was a benevolent power and would be seen as such. But it has to also be that democracy itself was seen as the natural state of order, or that it would emerge if you just kick dictatorships over, or that it would, you know, come about. What's your sense from the interviews you've done, both inside and outside the country, about what would happen to democracy if the United States got out of the way, if the United States didn't interfere in the democracy agenda or the freedom agenda?
Right. Well, so there's another view which would say, there's another possibility which says, you know what, the best way to promote democracy is to behave like a democracy. Model democracy. I mean, obviously, I think that's a prerequisite, but I don't think that will cause it in itself. I think the real question that you're going to, Alex, is to what extent Can any actor, a state actor, let's even leave aside the United States for a second, can any state actor do anything really important to alter a process that otherwise appears to be so organic as to be almost vegetable? This slow, slow process whereby democracies became democracies. Why do we think that this is more like some kind of medical condition that a skilled doctor can alter? You know, and the answer is, I think, that one can accelerate, if only just so much, this organic process, and also that there are critical moments in the life of a state where diplomatic intervention, above all by us because we have that kind of diplomatic power, can make a difference. And so it made a difference in the Reagan era when they finally turned against Chile and they finally turned against the Philippines. Ever since we have been trying to do this, it has at times, at critical pivot moments, made a difference. So it might have made a difference in Egypt. We'll never know. I'm skeptical that it would have, but it might have. And so I think we have to keep working both at the low and slow level, this kind of organic level, and then at the high and dramatic level of public acts of diplomacy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, part of the reason I asked the question also is there is this sense, as you know, some of the democracy experts have started talking about a democracy recession, where you've seen 2 years of net setbacks. The overall Freedom House sort of scorecard of free and partly free states hasn't declined. It's flattened out. But right. There is that sense of sort of where is democracy going, in part dependent on the role of outside states, particularly the U.S., but more broadly of outside states, but in part also just sort of the natural evolution of democracy. Has a 30-year period run its course?
Yeah, I don't know about these kinds of long wave theories. I have no idea. If I had to guess, I would say probably the high price of oil has had as much to do with that as anything. That is to say, if you want to produce an authoritarian state, all you need to do is combine oil and natural gas with shortages, raise the price, and then almost any country that has this immense torrent of money running through it, the state turns into this thing to capture. All activity focuses on the state. The state becomes corrupt. The state becomes more autocratic. And it's not easy to find exceptions to that outside of Europe. And so I think there are cases like Venezuela and some of the African states where the high price of oil has absolutely consolidated autocratic governments and has enormously weakened democratic opposition.
Right. Now we're seeing that price sort of shift pretty radically.
I don't think there's any point in our trying to do anything with Russia.
Yeah.
The only democracy promotion strategy we can have with Russia is the conservation of energy. If we can reduce the price of oil, that increases the pressure on Putin.
Yeah. Just a sort of second part of what you had said also, we've done a series of interviews asking the strategic community in the United States, the foreign policy thinkers, about is democracy promotion the right words for a new administration to use in its public diplomacy, or should it change course? I expected the word democracy would be challenged, and it has been challenged much less so than the word promotion.
That's the bad word.
That is. In most of the interviews that we've seen, everyone's saying support, maybe assist, but that sounds too economics only, but support is the one that's coming across.
Right.
Do you think a new administration should sort of shift? I mean, Tom Carruthers talks about the modern phase of democracy promotion in the United States being from Reagan forward, where democracy promotion was really used. Is it time for that era to shift to an era of democracy support with a new administration rather than democracy promotion?
I guess the question is that just a word or is it a thing? I mean,
frankly,
you know, I use this word spread because publishers don't like it if you use some meek, timid word like support, you know, so I couldn't get away with that. Promotion, to me, has a combination of American arrogance and attention Kmart shoppers. It's a really, you know, really bad word. So I think the question is not, will we stop using this terrible word and change, use another word in its stead? I think the question is, what's the framework within which we talk about this? And that's why I say in Obama's case, I think it is fixing failed states, helping weak states, things like that. Of which democracy is a not wholly included subset, in effect. But it's going to be, I think, easier to talk to the American people about why it is in our interest to help weak states. It has less of a made in America, our special form of medicine quality. It jibes with a growing analysis from the military about what our role is, as I mentioned, from stability ops. And so it may be that both the words democracy and both the word democracy and promotion will be shunted off to the side, not to say eliminated, in favor of something else.
Yeah. Well, I've had you for long enough. Let me open this up to the group as a whole. If I can ask folks, if you have a question, just to raise your hand to let me know. And if you can identify yourself just quickly by your name and your institution so that we know it, give you a chance to ask Jim the questions that are on your mind. Or I can go at you for another half hour.
Hello, I'm Manuel Lafont-Apnouy. I'm a visiting fellow here at CSIS. I have a question on this wording issue, and I would like to ask the question about human rights. Because I think this wording issue also is not just changing the brand or marketing. It also has substantial impact. And you are working on responsibility to protect. There are also issues of economic and social justice. Do you think that, how do you relate this democracy effort, be it support or spreading or anything, that we should do with human rights policy? Don't you think that the focus that was on democracy actually wasn't very helpful as far as human rights were concerned in a broader dimension? Thank you.
Well, I think that's a really important point. Now, let me for a second try to be fair to the Bush administration. When Condi Rice went to Egypt and gave the speech, the whole point was a rule of law point. She said, you can't continue practicing this form of arbitrary justice. You have to allow people to express themselves. She went on at some length about issues that you would call rule of law type issues. Nevertheless, it seems to me this administration had a classically American, classically liberal in the old-fashioned sense, definition of what democracy is, which is to say, in Isaiah Berlin's terms, as negative liberty, that is a freedom from. And so, yes, these rights were defined almost completely in political terms, the right to vote, the right to speak, right of assembly and all that. No sense that there is some connection between the kinds of daily issues of economic justice and social justice that people who would only hope someday to aspire to these political rights that people face every day. Now, I don't know whether human rights is the right container for that bunch of concerns, but we have to find a way of talking about this so that when we are trying to persuade ordinary people in impoverished countries that this democracy thing is not some airy substance that you can't taste, but actually is something that makes a difference in their lives, it has to much more plainly include economic and social issues. And by the way, Obama, again, in his speeches, always makes a point of talking about that.
If I can just second one thing on that also, in the U.S. foreign policy context, it would be very difficult because human rights was so affiliated with a failed Carter administration's foreign policy.
Yes, that's a very good point.
That trying to put it in that context domestically in the U.S. would be very difficult to resurrect. Yeah.
Good morning. Jeff Goldstein from Freedom House. You talked about the long-term nature of democracy building in any given country, and yet we live here in a country that lives off of one-year budget cycles, and a capital city that is always consumed by the crisis of the day, both in terms of its intentions, its attention, and its use of resources. So in terms of the next administration, how do you square the problem of a short-term focus on tactics and the long-term nature of the problem? I mean, even the Millennium Challenge account, which was an attempt to deal with this, is really only 2 or 3 year programs.
Yeah, of course, that question applies to, you know, everything. It applies to our inability to do entitlement reform. One possible answer to that is I was saying that there's a kind of high and low version of democracy promotion. And the high version, which has to do with diplomacy, is always going to be completely determined by the political agenda of the administration in question. Now, the low agenda is something else, for which, because we're not going to get a whole lot of political credit, it's always going to be maybe a little bit of a stepchild. But one thought is our private, semi-private, whatever we're going to call them, democracy promotion bodies, the NED, the NDI, the IRI, do a whole bunch of things quite effectively on the ground. And it has been suggested, Mike McFaul and Frank Fukuyama wrote a piece where they said all of the operative things that are now done by AID and others on the ground with the Made in America label should be done by NDI, IRI, NED, because in fact it is easier for them to do it because they don't have the Made in America label. And they are less susceptible to the ideological changes of new administrations and so forth. And so it would be, I don't think it's terribly likely that they'll get a big increase in funding. I think they should. And I think that when you ask, you know, where's the operational ability going to come to which will help Americans train civil servants, train police, things like that, maybe the answer is through them, precisely because they are both less connected to the label and also less connected to political vicissitudes.
Yeah, in the back.
Hi, I'm Vemba Dizolela. I'm with the Hoover Institution. What do you think the role of election monitoring is now? Because when you see, especially what's happening in Africa, the Carter Centers and the likes will go and monitor election. At the end, do not add any serious value, I think, in the sense that the result, the statement already known beforehand, in spite of irregularities, the process was fair, when in fact the people know it was not fair. I've had the experience of being an observer, where we went in the villages and recorded, harvested all kind of information. We never heard it mentioned a single time in during the process. Again, it's always, although there were irregularities, everything was okay. Next thing you know, you have riot in the city, as was in Kenya, and the process is actually in question. Is this a new type of business where people are getting contracts? There's a lot of money involved. Why not strengthen the local institutions so they can do the monitoring? They know what's happening. Thanks.
I'd say a couple things about that. First, I think you're being a little, and it sounds like you've had really bad experience to justify those feelings. I don't know if that's a fair universal criticism. I mean, after all, the most recent election we had was in Azerbaijan, which was quite heavily criticized by international monitors, and the Azerbaijanis were furious. And in some ways, it is easier for outsiders to make those criticisms. But it is absolutely right that this should be, whenever it can be, a domestic capacity. And one thing, in fact, which groups like NDI have done is train election monitors, help push for independent electoral bodies in order to do this. I mean, one of the big problems in autocratic countries is they refuse to have independent electoral agencies. And so the electoral body itself is an arm of the government, and election monitoring itself gets subordinated to the state. And so the key thing is to have genuinely independent election monitors, and I think whenever they can be, domestic ones working with international ones, that's the ideal solution.
In the middle.
My name is Wilson of the CSIS Africa program. Some scholars have argued that for democracy to be successful, it has to be demanded by the people of the country where it's being spread or being promoted. And they have also said that, but for them to be able to make that demand, there has to be a reference point in their culture or tradition and their values for that democratic tradition. So my question is this feasible, and how do we sow that seed of democratic values that the people can use as a reference point to demand for democracy?
You know, that's a really hard question, because I think your question is, to what extent should we think about democracy the way, for example, we think about Catholicism, as a thing which may have a body of dogma somewhere, but takes a radically different form in every place it goes because it takes on the shape of the place. And what kinds of institutions can actually, how far away can you warp those institutions based on local shape? And there clearly are limits to that. People in the Middle East who say, we already have democracy. We have a shura system, which is a Quranic form of council. Well, the answer is, no, that's really not democracy. At the same time, there are, for example, local systems of adjudication, which are very deeply rooted in the country, which work for them. And so I don't think I have a kind of overall answer to that question, except that to say that in every country there is a kind of negotiating process over time between institutions that feel borrowed and over time one wishes to make them feel natural, and those which are indigenous and have to be fitted to a genuinely democratic arrangement. This is, I think, a matter of slow evolution.
Rick?
Good morning. Rick Barton from CSIS. We spent a lot of time working on Pakistan in the last few years, sort of anticipating that it would be a problem that would be larger than all of us could possibly imagine. And it seems to be fulfilling that potential right now. I guess I have two questions. One, you spent a lot of time working around the international system, and we felt when we've been in Pakistan that there is a genuine democratic surge on the part of the public. It hasn't been reciprocated by either the United States or necessarily by their own senior political leadership, but nevertheless, it's there. But I guess my first question is, why does Pakistan have to become America's democracy challenge? Why isn't it more international? Because it's way too big for us to deal with. And how might that happen? And the second part of my question would be, assuming that there are always going to be leadership development gaps in most of these places, my impression through the years has been you have to work at the farm system level, and you better find promising talent wherever you can. It's hardly ever going to be the president or the head of the parliament. Why don't we do this more, and what promise do you see for that as an approach?
Well, for the first one, of course, you're absolutely right. I think what I was saying is it is the United States' most important task, but it is not the task only of the United States. It is equally the most important task for others, for the OSCE and the EU, and for others who taken up this burden, obviously for NATO itself. So I don't mean to imply in any way that it should be a made in America question. But your second question goes to all the long-term issues we're talking about. And if you look at Pakistan's current political leadership, they have yet to really create a mass-based political party. That is, they have political parties. I mean, Bhutto was the first kind of populist political figure, and so he would have rallies with hundreds of thousands of people. And in that sense, it is a popular party. But it consists almost entirely of members of the elite and very heavily of the old landowning elite. And when I was in Pakistan and I was meeting members of the PPP, of Bhutto's party, I would meet these young guys who had just gotten elected. And I would think, God, that's great. And I would talk to them, how did you get into politics? Well, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, it was a hereditary position. And so if democratic politics is ever going to get more deeply rooted and more legitimate in Pakistan, it has to feel more like India, where local systems of democracy are sufficiently powerful and the parties are sufficiently genuinely rooted that all sorts of forces bubble up from the ground and you have all the different castes are represented. It's really ugly because naturally all the forms of caste and tribal rivalry that take place at the local level repeat themselves at the national level. But that's the only way you get a representative political system. And ultimately, in all that horse trading, people have to begin thinking nationally because they want to have a national appeal. Now, what can outsiders, including the United States, do about that? You know, there's certain things that, for example, again, NDI, IRI, NED do in terms of political party organization. It's very unspectacular work, but I think if you talk to people like Tom Carruthers, they would say political parties are the heretofore ignored axis of democratic growth. And so whatever we can do to help make political parties more effective and more representative will pay off long-term dividends.
Let me piggyback off that for 1 second, because if you talk to administration officials, they will tell you that they turned in their approaches to Pakistan when some of the opposition became clear that they did lean on Musharraf, but they did it through private channels. They didn't do it publicly. I understand the skepticism. Mike McFaul's written a piece a few years ago talking about engaging autocratic allies. And he looked at the Reagan administration and said, you look at South Korea, you look at Chile, you look at the Philippines. If you go publicly, especially given where the U.S. is now internationally, against these regimes, you back them into a corner where they are more likely to dig in than if you go through private channels. Can the United States get out of this trap where you have to either isolate or publicly chastise another country in order to be perceived as promoting democracy when working through private channels in the slower form may be more effective in getting the regime not to dig in? Is there a catch-22 in that public pressure by the United States backfires?
Well, I think the Reagan examples are really complicated because the public signals of support that Reagan was sending to precisely those countries helped those guys dig in. Though ultimately it was when Reagan sent his emissary Paul Laxalt privately to Marcos and said the time has come, step down. The reason I roll my eyes is I don't believe it about Musharraf. I think the signals that we were sending to Musharraf were at the very best ambivalent. The signals that we were sending to the opposition was that they just didn't figure in our thinking. Our thinking was Musharraf and Bhutto, and that Benazir Bhutto, and that was our thought. And during that whole, I think what also happened is that we were way behind the curve in realizing that Musharraf had lost credibility with his own people. And so we thought, he's still the most popular figure, he's still our guy, we should continue to support him. And it was only in quite late 2007, when he declared martial law, that we then began to lean on him in order to undo that. We didn't lean on him very heavily either. And certainly this is my impression from talking to our ambassador there, among others. So no, I think we were deeply at fault there. Now, take an example like Egypt. That's a really interesting example. We did put Mubarak into a corner, and Mubarak called our bluff, and then we backed down. So that clearly didn't work. And so that raises the question of, should we either have not backed down? What would that have done any good? I'm very skeptical that it would have. Or should we have used private diplomacy? The problem with the quiet diplomacy is that normally, especially in the Middle East, if you don't say something in public, it doesn't really matter. You can ignore it. And so if we made private representations to Mubarak, you know, look, you've got to release Ayman Noor. He doesn't want to do it, of course. He's only going to do it if he has to do it. And so unless the private representations included some kind of or else, I'm not quite sure what it would have accomplished.
Yeah. In the middle there.
Bob Hamilton from CSIS. What do you think we should do when our support for democratizing countries, specifically right now I'm talking about Georgia, Ukraine, and some of the other countries in the post-Soviet periphery, when it brings us into conflict and brings them into conflict with anti-democratic regimes that have identified democracy on their periphery as a threat to their national interest?
Well, so that may be a generic problem, but it is above all a piercingly specific problem as to what we should do with Georgia and Ukraine. And I am, you know, very on record as being a pro-Georgia in these matters. For all that it's a terribly flawed democracy, I think it's a very real democracy with real potential. I think that, and it also shows that a democratic country on the border of an undemocratic country is often a real threat to that undemocratic country. And for all that Putin's terribly popular, he's also quite paranoid about any kind of threat. Now, rather than kind of erect a general theory about what one should do in such general circumstances, because certainly you never want to pursue any policy to the point where it violates really deep national security principles, in this particular case of Georgia and Ukraine and Russia, I would say Russia's unwillingness to accept what it views as disobedient neighbors, which is to say non-subservient neighbors, is not acceptable, should not be acceptable to us. Russia's means of dealing with these refractory neighbors is also should be unacceptable to us and is. So for a long time, it was purely economic. And I think Putin really wanted to make clear that he would not limit himself only to economic acts. I mean, I think it hasn't really in fact only been economic. There's cyber war. There clearly are large numbers of Russian agents who are at work throughout the Caucasus area. But the actual war that took place in August, to me, was something Putin had been seeking for a long time. It wasn't clear whether it would happen in Abkhazia or South Ossetia. He knew that Saakashvili would take the bait at some point. Saakashvili is quite dependable in terms of taking bait. And he did. And then Putin got the war he wanted. And so I think it's really essential that we make it clear that we don't think that hostilities are an acceptable way of doing business with neighboring democracies any more than we do that trying to starve them into submission is. But this one is way more serious. So I guess one question would be, is the reason that we should be staunchly supporting Georgia and Ukraine because they are democracies threatened by an autocracy, or is it something more like Kuwait as opposed to Iraq, that we should be defending their territorial integrity against a country which seems quite heedless of their territorial integrity? I would just say those two interests converge in this case, and so I am glad that this administration has taken a staunch view, and I'm glad that both McCain and Obama have taken a staunch view of that one.
Yeah, in the front. Sorry, behind you. There you go.
Betsy Clark, a former NED fellow. Just to follow up on Georgia, isn't the situation a little more complicated because of Abkhazia, the populations in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, at least 50% of them don't want to be a part of Georgia.
Than 50% want to be a part of Georgia. All of them except the Georgians.
Right, but didn't they kick in Abkhazia, didn't they kick out a lot of Georgians during the war in the early 90s?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a little unclear, but that's a democracy issue, and not just in Georgia, but in many other places in the world. Somaliland, many other places in the world. I wish you would give us your opinion on that.
The Abkhaz, I had gone to Georgia and to Abkhazia in June, and then it turned out this war broke out, so I wound up writing a truncated version of the article I had initially written. And so I didn't get to include much of what I found in Abkhazia, which is that the Abkhaz view the Georgians the way the Georgians view the Russians. Huge, domineering, brutal, indifferent to their own welfare. And in fact, when I said this to Saakashvili, he just dismissed me. This is just Abkhaz propaganda. And you can go more microscopic if you want. The Mingrelian Georgians in Abkhazia view the Abkhaz the way the Abkhaz view the Georgians. It's like Russian dolls. So yes, I mean, until the Russians attacked Georgia, I would have said this is a profoundly complicated situation where the Georgians are acting as heedless, dominating powers, which Saakashvili has eagerly underwritten. I mean, he is the cause to a large extent of that. And the Georgians' own moral claims are deeply compromised by their unwillingness to take seriously the concerns of the Abkhaz. The Ossetians a little less so. Russia's onslaught against Georgia has temporarily wiped away those more complicated and still enduring problems. And so, if and when the Russians withdraw, we will still be facing the fact that we haven't resolved the Abkhaz and Ossetian problem. But right now, I think it's important to focus more on what the Russians did to Georgia than what the Georgians have been doing over time to Abkhazia.
Got time for one last question in the back.
Travis Elliott from CSIS. Last week, President Zardari went to meet with Hu Jintao to ask for over $1 billion in aid to boost the economic infrastructure in Pakistan. And I believe it was even reported today that Pakistan may be going to the IMF as well. I was wondering if you could speak to the influence that these other nation states and other multilateral organizations have on U.S. Democracy promotion efforts in these critical states.
There was a time when the West had this whole world to itself. If you were a poor country in need of help, you either got it from a Western bilateral donor or you got it from a Western-dominated multilateral agency, IMF or the World Bank. We live in a different world now. So yes, the Pakistanis look up and they say, well, Russia, they've got a lot of money, they'll give us money. This is joined even more in China. In Africa, where China has gone around country to country, which has sizable resources, above all oil, but not only oil, and has locked up these deals, which among other things include concessional loans and grants which are on better terms than the IMF or the World Bank can offer and have no conditions. That's their whole premise. And so this is a problem that no one has yet figured out. I mean, the point is not we have to beat the Chinese at their game. The Chinese are going to be doing that, and they build a lot of dams and highways and train systems, and that's good. But it also winds up reinforcing the worst aspects of the political culture of these countries. And so how the World Bank, for example, and how Western bilateral donors can raise the ante sufficiently so as to make their conditions that will feel onerous to any autocratic leader, to make them nevertheless attractive enough that it's not simply a question of China supplanting those Western donors, that is a big ongoing question. And the financial crisis, of course, has only made it that much harder to answer.
Well, thanks very much. I've got at least a couple things out of this, one of which is for the Democracy Promotion Program for Pakistan, the slogan should be more like India in the next administration.
Yes, that's my view.
And the foreign policy...
Pakistanis love hearing that.
Right, exactly. And the foreign policy paradigm for the former Soviet states is the Matryoshka doll. And if we could just get that right, then we're in good shape. I want to thank you very much for coming. You've got a bit of a whirlwind today. I believe you're going to stay for, is it 15 or 30 minutes in the back to sign books? Or have I got that wrong? Or just for a few minutes?
I have half an hour. So.
Great. His previous books, including the one on the UN, has been called Page Turners, so you can imagine what he does with this subject in the Freedom Agenda. But for now, if you all can join me in thanking Jim Traub for coming and sharing his thoughts and his research with us.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you.